This podcast is generously supported by Themis Bar Review. For more information about Themis, check out themisbar.com. That is themisbar.com. Thank you very much. And now back to the show. All right. Welcome to Digging a Hole, the Legal Theory Podcast. On this podcast, my co-host, Sam Moyne, and I, David Schleicher, talk about legal theory and whatever else is on our minds. What's up, Sam? How you doing?
Doing well. Just heading off to Australia and Asia for weeks. So, you know, we've gotten in a podcast just under the wire.
And I think we've made it kind of relaxing and cool for you before we go, haven't we? Who do we have on the pod with us?
It's a very mellow pod because we're hearing from Dave Posen. David Posen is the Charles Keller Beekman Professor of Law at Columbia, and he has a new book out called "The Constitution of the War on Drugs."
It's gonna be a cool, relaxing, fun, trippy podcast. So let's get to it.
Okay, it's great to have David Posen on the podcast to talk about his new book, The Constitution of the War on Drugs. Now, Dave, you're going to have to talk a lot more than our usual guests because I prepared by raiding my partner's edibles, and David Schleicher texted me that he's been toking up since dawn. So what is this book about?
I mean, I get a lava lamp in the back. It's wild.
Thanks for inviting me on. The book is a kind of critical constitutional history of drug prohibition in the United States, with a focus on the 1960s and 1970s window in which various kinds of drug rights claims were actively debated and litigated and even made headway in the courts before ultimately losing out. So it's a recovery of this lost history of constitutional challenges to draconian drug laws.
Amazing. So you take as a premise that the war on drugs failed. That's not your game. Your question is, you know, could the Constitution have done better? And were there lost opportunities that failed for whatever reason? So I came to think of it as a kind of, you know, dog didn't bark book, you know, that I forget, it's Silver Blaze or some Sherlock Holmes nerd can correct us, where Holmes says a dog didn't bark, and Holmes says, Watson says, what's the big deal? And that's the significant event. And in your story, the Constitution doesn't help. So could you just first, is that form of argument? Like, did I get it right? And could you illustrate maybe specifically by talking about the privacy, liberty, like values that our great Constitution protects?
So I would say it's in part a story of the dog that didn't bark or bite, whichever it is.
It's definitely bark.
Bark. Okay. How constitutional law could have helped curb the worst excesses of the war on drugs, but didn't. But it's also partly a story of what that failure teaches us about constitutional law and development. So trying to do both things. On privacy, liberty, that basically follows from Griswold. So there's an old set of libertarian arguments for drug rights rooted in the structural limits of the police power or state constitutions. Protection of the right to pursuit of happiness. That was a fascinating and productive area in the late 1800s and early 1900s, but it gets vanquished in the 1910s as the courts embrace a broader understanding of regulatory power. But then in the 1960s, you get Griswold and these civil libertarian rulings recognizing a right to privacy. Drug reformers quickly perceive that this could be a tool to challenge drug laws, at least as they apply in the home, and at least as they apply to so-called soft drugs that are physically non-addictive. And so they start bringing Griswold-based challenges to drug prohibition and winning in a few state courts on slightly different grounds, but basically on the theory that it's an unjustified incursion on adults' privacy when they are prohibited from consuming relatively mild substances of their choice in the home. And the most famous ruling to this effect was the Alaska Supreme Court's Raven versus State ruling in 1975, still on the books, that Alaskans have a right to privacy that encompasses the right to possess and use small amounts of marijuana in the home. So that's just a concrete example of how there was a specific constitutional justification, that one grounded in privacy, that had some potential legs, that made some headway in the 1970s, that President Nixon's own National Commission on Marijuana and Drug Abuse almost endorsed, or at least recognized the force of, and yet by the 1980s had lost out.
Now, I just want to say this is if I'm choosing one adjective to describe this amazing book, it's ingenious, because you just do a great job showing how in all of these domains, like liberty, there were credible possibilities, at least doctrinally. And I'll just list what your other chapters are about. And then I'm curious, what, you know, why did you choose them? Is it that, like, the promising, you know, alleyways that turned out to be dead ends were just these? So you have a chapter on federalism, you have a chapter on equal protection, especially racial equality. You have a chapter on, you know, limitations to punishment that are allegedly in our Constitution. You have a chapter on the First Amendment, and, you know, we're familiar with, you know, peyote bans and things like that. And then you close the book just with some, like, reflective chapters. So that's the list. How did you come up with it?
Yeah, the basic criterion for selection was, what were the constitutional claims that got traction in the mainstream legal community? So where you see legal scholars and government commissions and courts embracing the argument to some extent in some form, then I thought that was worthy of writing up what happened. And so you named a lot of the main sorts of constitutional arguments that made headway. I should say there's a whole other kind of subaltern class of arguments that did not make headway. My favorite of which is an argument that was bandied about a bit in the late 60s, that the right to trip on psychedelic drugs is covered by the right to travel, the right to travel from one state of consciousness to another. That did not make headway in the courts, but just
right. Sounds plausible.
Yeah. You know. as particularly creative. So, I basically went clause by clause and looked at where reformers were making progress with their constitutional arguments. And then, as you say, pan out at the end of the book to kind of structural features of constitutional law that were inhospitable to their project.
So the book starts off, the first sentence and then the last sentence of the first paragraph, with total bangers. First sentence, just for our listeners, is it's hard to think of a contemporary public policy regime more discredited than the war on drugs. And the last sentence of the first paragraph starts off with the Charles Black reference. In the war on drugs, the curves of callousness and stupidity intersect at their respective maxima. But I have a question, or maybe a skeptical question about this, which is, like, is the war on drugs really that discredited? So if you look at the time maybe the book was written, it certainly seemed that the world had moved in that direction. Since then, though, like, full drug decriminalization in Oregon has proved wildly unpopular, like wildly, wildly unpopular. Several candidates for president, including one who might win, have proposed invading Mexico, like a literal war on drugs to stop the flow of fentanyl. I think expert opinion on decriminalization of marijuana, which is still in favor, has found that the actual methods of decriminalization have been, let's say, suboptimal, particularly the extremely low taxes and the high, the increased evidence of high costs to like a high use by extreme users, much like alcohol in that way. And then relatedly, then there are weird policy disasters like whatever's happening in New York City about the illegal stores everywhere. So like, while I wonder a little bit about whether this is a moment in time that like public opinion is now going in the other direction, which will affect some of the, I think will pretty clearly affect some of the constitutional questions. I think that's part of the story here. But like the drug war on drugs is certainly discredited in academia and certain aspects of it are clearly deeply unpopular. But it's not obvious to me, at least, that it is true that the country thinks of the ending of the war on drugs, or at least the move from the war on drugs to decriminalization as a gain, even the expert community.
Yeah, I think there are hugely difficult questions about how best to move beyond the war on drugs, how to pursue legalization or decriminalization. New York's rollout of marijuana legalization has been farcical. Sometimes it feels to me almost as if someone is trying to discredit the legalization movement by doing it so poorly. So I'm happy to kind of acknowledge all of that. But it does seem to me that the punitive prohibitionist approach, as I describe it in the book, where you target drug problems through criminal sanctions, including for use and possession, is a proven failure under, as I say at one point in the book, any plausible definition of failure, not only in terms of cost to racial justice or individual liberty, but also in terms of dangerous drug behaviors, which tend to go significantly up, not down, under criminal regimes. So I guess I think you're right as a diagnostic that we're in a new political moment in which there's new skepticism about drug legalization, liberalization. I think that speaks to the difficulty of how to implement a saner, healthier, more humane drug policy than it in no way redeems the prior regime, which was even more monstrous and produced even worse outcomes.
So, but this leads to like one of the big questions, which is one of the problems of constitutionalizing things in the American constitutional system, is that it leads to kind of all or nothing outcomes very frequently. Yeah. And it strikes me that like the book is like these lost pathways for potential for constitutional law. And you wonder a little bit about whether like given the kind of vast shift in opinion on legalization, and we're seeing some of the downsides of that, with our constitutionalization of, like what the merits of it would have been, or whether there was wisdom in letting democracy play out in this score.
Yeah, I think there are versions of constitutionalizing drug rights less familiar in this country than in proportionality regimes all around the world that would not have this winner-takes-all quality and could lead to a much saner approach, and also a foregrounding of a positive right to health in which treatment of drug users could be nested rather than, just a kind of a pure negative liberty approach. I've been thinking about this. This is kind of beyond the book, but how once we get legalization of a substance like marijuana in this country, constitutional law then pathologizes regulation. So for example, under the First Amendment, if a product is lawful, then commercial speech, including advertising about that product, is protected since 1976. This is not the case in other countries where drugs like marijuana have been legalized, but advertising is severely restricted, if not banned, which may be actually the best approach to dealing with a psychoactive substance like that. In America, by contrast, if you get legalization through the political process, you will get advertising. Commercial advertising galore, for whatever product is legalized. So that maybe speaks to your kind of all or nothing point, that some of the sane compromises that other countries have reached are taken off the table by constitutional law here.
Yeah, so I worry a little bit there about the old joke about the most boring headline in the world, worthwhile Canadian initiative. It's like it's like a worthwhile Portuguese decriminalization. But so this is one thing that actually quite interests me about the history of the book that I was kind of, which the, this is a, like a politics without interest groups. So there's no other than normal. There's not a lot of, and meet sometimes the prosecutors show up, but there's no one like lobbying really, except for kind of mass opinion or something. But the question is like, why didn't Philip Morris, who would obviously have been the largest player in marijuana legalization, in, if marijuana was legal, like fully legalized or constitutionalized, you'd imagine it, tobacco companies would have, like, where were not just the like normative advocates, but the like actual interests who would have invested money and effort into this effort?
Fascinating. Their absence is a question I take up, but the pharmaceutical companies, I don't think it's obvious that they would have benefited from marijuana legalization. In the short term, it might have been competition for some of their products. In addition, there are intellectual property questions about what they could control. The pharmaceutical companies tend to prefer synthetics that they can make in a lab and get clear intellectual property protection for, and have tended to oppose legalization of drugs that grow in the wild. In any event, I think it's very interesting that illegal drugs are so widely used now and in this period the book focuses on, by which I mean roughly half of the adult population is using them in any given year, and yet no coalition emerges to push for legalization or at least reduced criminalization. That's one puzzle I take up in chapter six, I think. There, I invoke Bruce Ackerman's, famous critique of Carolean products, where he talks about how it's not necessarily discrete and insular minorities, but diffuse and anonymous pluralities of the population that lose out in the political process. And that, I think, characterizes pretty well the drug scene. You have tons of drug users who are largely anonymous to each other, largely in the closet, and don't coalesce into an effective lobby. You have a few isolated groups like Normal, as you say, but their membership remains small throughout this period. And basically the liberal professional managerial class that might have seemed like the obvious powerful political group to engage because so many of them are using drugs, they feel adequately protected, I think, by the fact that they and their kids are largely not subject to the criminal regime, that they're not motivated to engage, in addition to the politics of tough on crime and the war on drugs, making it costly for them to do so. So in addition, I talk about how what never really emerges with drug rights, as with gun rights, say, or gay rights, is some sort of affirmative identitarian case for the project. Like we proudly identify as X and therefore seek protection from those who would oppress us. People aren't generally making much more defensive claims about drugs and the evils of overpunishment rather than the benefits of drugs in their communities or their lives. So for a bunch of reasons, no such coalition emerges, and that I think helps explain how easy it is for the judges to move away from the more libertarian doctrine in the 80s.
Dave, I want to ask about contingency. Because I'd say most of the book is interested in doctrinal possibilities, not political realities, or only secondarily. And in this regard, it joins a very, familiar set of books, The Lost Promise of This, The Accidental That, which say, look, the past is surprising.
That was cold, by the way, Sam. Sorry. That was straight cold.
I wrote a book about how human rights were allegedly contingent, which, I've disowned it, but never mind. But it's not about any frenemies. It's about, this is about myself. The question is about myself, not just Dave. I guess I've been thinking and surveying the wreckage of all this that, I guess I don't understand why we wouldn't in the end be most concerned with why winners win. And in that regard, you distinguish between external and internal causes, but we have theories like progressive neoliberal theory, Nancy Fraser or your own colleague Bernard Harcourt, about why, just to take the, you know, chapter I asked you about before, some versions of freedom are canonized and other people are treated punitively. And so why isn't the book kind of about necessity, and why these, it was a pipe dream to think these constitutional, you know, arguments could have legs in a system in which actually they didn't?
That's a great question and a deep one. So I think I have a few thoughts on that. So I think it may be true that over a long enough time horizon, it was overdetermined that these claims would lose because of progressive neoliberalism, racism, pharmaceutical lobby power, and other forces. That story has been told. You know, that is in fact the conventional wisdom on the evolution of the drug war. What hasn't been told is the legal side. And so one not satisfactory beginning of an answer is just a point about academic division of labor, you know, and so I'm bringing in another piece of the historical story. More perhaps, you know, interesting answers, I think, include the politics of drugs were complicated in the 1960s and 70s. And there were more possibilities then, which is not to say they wouldn't have been foreclosed later. The historian David Musto, is a leading drug historian, for example, says that there was a trend toward greater toleration of drug use throughout the country, beginning in the 1960s, that peaked in 1978 to 1980. So this is a period in which elites are open to drug liberalization in ways that they hadn't been previously, wouldn't be later. So that opens up this window of possibility. But beyond that, I guess it seems to me that even if law is ultimately epiphenomenal, is ultimately going to be overdetermined by social logics, political forces, it can have some entrenching effect for some amount of time. So that if, say, marijuana rights for adults had been recognized in the 1970s, which was a particularly plausible claim at the time, that would have protected that drug at least for some amount of time against subsequent political rollback. So partly is that there's an issue of temporality, you know, like within a certain time horizon, I think constitutional law is efficacious and matters. In addition, some of the drug cases I talk about go on to have deforming effects on other areas of constitutional development. So whatever led to their ultimate outcomes, once they come down and the drug cases are resolved in certain ways, it in turn affects the development of other constitutional doctrines. So if you care about the evolution of constitutional doctrine more generally, you should care about these cases. And then I guess last thing I'll say for the moment is, it seems to me that the standard story about what drove outcomes on drug policy, like neoliberalism and racism, has a hard time explaining certain legal outcomes in certain periods. What happens with the treatment of addiction, for example, under the Eighth Amendment in the 1960s, and how courts initially are open to recognizing a whole new set of protections for drug addicts and then shut that down by the early 1970s, really doesn't track any clear political story about sympathy, declining sympathy for drug addicts. It is hard to explain without reference to the doctrinal dynamics. So in a way that's kind of funny for me, because I do not identify as a doctrinalist or a formalist, it seems to me that the law needs to be brought back into the story of the war on drugs to make sense within a short to medium time horizon of what's actually happening in all these areas of case law.
So I have a quick follow-up, just like right on point, which is that, for the, I'm completely convinced that the law could have, like, the location of marijuana along the dimension of alcohol to heroin is not in any way obvious. But when we tell the story about the causal forces here, it just seems like it was unpopular. It's just like a Supreme Court follows the election returns type result, which is that the people who were willing to, or in the gun rights sort of way, the people who cared about it didn't like it, and no one else, it was never a like a enough of a voting issue for enough people to matter, whereas other things were. And so is it an election returns thing, or is it like it's just like we don't need progressive neoliberalism, and maybe that using that to explain that? Or is it like Nancy Reagan killed these cases more than anything else? Question mark.
Sorry, the question is whether marijuana liberalization was ever...
Was it just unpopular enough or never popular enough? Like, it was just like a, if you, I don't know, you go polls on things or whatever, it just never popular enough to, or never a big enough voting issue for anyone to care about changing the rules against strong entrenched interests of people who were in favor of it, of enforcement.
Yeah, though I don't know how strong or entrenched those interests were with marijuana in the 60s and 70s. The standard kind of account of the rise of the anti-marijuana parents movement, for example, begins in the late 1970s, you know, in the suburbs, and then it informs the Reagan administration policy in the 80s. So it comes later. It is an interesting question. The polling, as I understand it, on legalization of a drug like marijuana only gets really favorable more recently. And medical marijuana is an important driver of that. That initially polls is very popular in the 1990s, and then kind of normalizes the idea of legalization, which then becomes increasingly popular over the 2000s. But I think it's partly kind of endogenous to constitutional law and to law more generally. Once people experience marijuana legalization, it tends to be quite popular. When it's put to a ballot initiative rather than handled in a legislature, it tends to be quite popular. And there are, you know, surging rates of use of marijuana throughout the 1970s, which suggests there was a constituency in the making, you know, if there. So I guess I don't think it's clear, you know, that where public opinion was on something like marijuana in this period. And certainly there are kind of cover, there's cover given to judges to find limited drug rights when you have, for example, the Schaefer Commission, the Nixon Commission on Marijuana and Drug Abuse in 1972, recommending decriminalization and saying that we can't find any significant risk to the public health with this drug. So 9 of the 13 members of that commission, President Nixon personally appointed, was not a liberal group. The American Bar Association, the American Medical Association, the National Council on Churches, the National Council of Rabbis, the Consumers Union, they're all supporting marijuana decriminalization in this period. So there are other indicia of popular and elite support for liberalization.
So I want to get super clear about kind of how you're answering these questions, because it's, you know, I think like there are huge dilemmas here that we all face. So at the beginning of your response to my question, you were saying things about how not just the doctrine hadn't been studied and you're filling a gap, but that there might be some relative autonomy of doctrinal possibilities, law is an epiphenomenal, blah, blah, blah. And even if like racism is enduring or whatever. And then you just come around to saying, well, we don't know about like what was possible across the board. So it's not about the divergence of law and everything else, but that the 60s and 70s were just this very extraordinary moment when there were a lot of alternative exits. And that was true not just at the level of doctrine, but at the level of social and political outcomes. But then it seems like you're embracing a contingency thesis and saying, like, it was a near thing. And we could have had drug liberalization along with Roe and Obergefell in due process or what, you know, on some other doctrinal line. And it just didn't happen for reasons that aren't about like powerful social forces that David says, you know, are just people like, you know, like we're just out there, but maybe society could have been very different.
I would just, I don't see a contradiction there. I would maybe characterize in terms of bounded possibility. You know, there are the drug policy may be powerfully determined or overdetermined, again, on a long enough time horizon that it's ultimately unfruitful to look at this or that line of cases and try to figure out where we ended up on heroin you know, say. But it can also be the case, and I don't think it's inconsistent with that concession, to think that in certain windows, with certain drugs and certain types of claims, we could have moved in a different direction. And if we didn't, we should consider whether something about the structure of constitutional law or adjudication was playing a role in not going in a direction, you know, we didn't go or going the direction we went, to make sense of that moment. I also think it's the case that there's some dialectical interaction between the way the law actually turns out in that moment and what happens at least in the next period. So there's, you know, I'm not sure this is fully satisfying, and I don't know exactly how to characterize the space of possibility here, just how long it lasted, just how far it could have gone. But it's, I do want to insist that there was some freedom of action for legal agents in this period, as exemplified by what a number of lower courts and state courts do, you know, in actually showing us new possibilities, even if at the end of the day, progressive neoliberalism was going to vanquish, you know, reformers' efforts. I don't know if that's satisfying. I have struggled with this big question throughout the project, and found it the toughest like methodological issue in trying to do a project like this.
So I have a whole bunch of questions that are a little more, at least one that's a little more internal to the legal sets of questions. Because one of the key points about this is like the legal doctrinal afterflow. So I was wondering a little bit about whether that some of the cases look weirder to us from a modern lens than they did at the time because of the ongoing demise of kind of morals legislation or kind of acceptance that like law embodies moral attitudes. And so I was thinking about this when I was reading the book, because I was sitting in a cafe, and there were two people smoking a joint, and they were complaining about people smoking cigarettes. So, it was a wonderful moment. But I wondered a little bit about whether, you know, while you spend about a lot of time talking about how we limit the police power to regulating externalities, and this makes regulation of drugs, but the concept of externalities was somewhat broader. I mean, we still see an echo of this in law sometimes. So in zoning cases, for instance, like you're allowed to justify zoning through externalities, but externalities are defined extraordinarily broadly.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering a little bit about whether like the story is really about shifting other parts of law while drugs stayed constant, something along those lines.
Can you explain that last part?
Sorry, no, maybe I didn't ask that. But like there's lots of things are changing when we're looking back at these cases about what they're doing about drugs in the 60s and 70s, or even earlier, your earlier cases, kind of post-prohibition cases. And that legal universe was quite different from ours. So how does that help? Like how does thinking about those cases today help us understand the story here?
Yeah, that's certainly true of the cases from the late 1800s and early 1900s, where the basic architecture of the doctrine is so unfamiliar that the idea, for example, that the police states simply cannot regulate matters of purely private concern is not our world. And so that is hard to recover. But I actually find that from the mid-1960s on, we're basically in the world of the New Deal settlement, and the doctrinal architecture is familiar, and I'm trying to point out some of its trade-offs and, you know, pathologies. But Griswold, I characterize as the not, you know, at all, you know, novel claim that as the watershed for attacks on vice regulation or morals regulation. So that comes in the mid-1960s. And then kind of makes it harder to justify drug prohibition just on grounds of an offense to public morality. And so what you see is government lawyers defending drug prohibition after Griswold, and we might add more cases like Department of Agriculture versus Moreno in the early 1970s says that animus toward a particular politically unpopular group like hippies, the actual group at issue in Moreno, is not a legitimate basis for legislation. And so government lawyers who want to defend drug prohibition are pushed away from their old morality arguments toward public health arguments and arguments about physical harm. And with some drugs like marijuana, that puts them in an awkward position because all the medical literature at the time is against them. And so they end up making like highly strained arguments about harm to bodies and brains because they're unable to kind of make the argument about fears of social dislocation, decay, or degrading public morality. And so you get this kind of their arguments look transparently weak to a lot of the judges of the 1970s, who have to assimilate them into this new framework of rational basis review, where moral arguments have no clear place. Sorry, that's not the crispest answer, but I guess I'm fighting the premise a bit that we're in such a different world from 65.
Later on. Cases, absolutely, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
So I want to kind of survey the options of the last chapter, which is really well done. And, you know, as you've kind of said, the whole book befits your self-understanding as a constitutional law scholar. And so this chapter, you know, sort of like your answer to our prior conversation about wanting to cover that stuff, this chapter covers like what can constitutional law do in response to this story. And you survey the kind of like kicking it old school, going back to original meaning, which could help if done like in a liberal way, I guess. The going European, basically, like where hippies won, but where proportionality doctrine would be kinder and gentler to drug criminals. And then the great last option, which, you know, I think we should pursue across the board, which is the kind of getting out of constitutional law. But then there's this tension because, you know, the whole book is about the very thing that it seems like the last option would lead us to get over. And so tell me about like why we shouldn't or why we should. And this book could be like a ladder that we throw away once we realize like all these constitutional possibilities notwithstanding, we shouldn't exploit them now and want to get them back. We should get drugs out, drug politics, like all politics, out of this constitutional domain, kind of on the model of what actually did happen.
Right. Great. A lot of things I could say. I guess U.S. constitutional law, as it's currently configured, seems to me at least capable of serving as a brake on overpunishment. That is entirely consistent with the structure of constitutional law today. So if we can't get optimal drug policy, or, you know, as David was getting at earlier, a healthier approach to legalization, I would hope we could at least get a limit on excessive punishment. On the larger question, I end up saying that originalism has a surprising set of resources for those who want to challenge punitive prohibition. Though I'm skeptical that those resources are actually going to be taken up by courts any time in the foreseeable future. Proportionality is actually working well by my lights around the world for dealing with drug claims, because it does not demand that you make any kind of special showing of a fundamental right that's been abridged or a special textually recognized rights guarantee that's been undermined. You just have to show that there's some liberty or equality or rationality dimension to your claim, you know, your critique of the drug laws or your desire to use whatever drug. And then the burden shifts to the government to justify its policies. And that's the real weakness, I think, of a lot of criminal drug policies, not that they offend a paramount autonomy interest that is so much greater than we have in other spheres of our lives, but that there's just a very weak case for criminal prohibition. And in fact, criminal prohibition tends to have horribly perverse consequences, even in terms of drug abuse. So other countries' constitutional adjudication allows them to weigh the costs and benefits of criminalizing drugs and find that at least for some drugs, criminal approaches are unjustified. And so if we're going to be doing constitutional, I know the real force of your question is, should we be doing that at all? I think that is the sanest way to capture the structure of the debate over prohibition, which is, again, really focusing on the lack of a legitimate government interest more than more than drug users' rights. But should we do constitutional law at all? So here, I think a kind of cheap answer is we're going to be doing it, whether we should or not. Why do I say that? The last year for which I found data, 1.5 million people were prosecuted for, I think I have that figure right, so whatever it is, it's in the book, for drug offenses. All those people risk prison time. Their lawyers have a duty to be zealous advocates for their clients. So just at the level of kind of responding to the needs of these not small group of defendants who risk going to prison, arguably unjustifiably, I think their lawyers should be armed with constitutional arguments to help them. So that's the beginning of an answer. And then beyond that, I guess it seems to me that there's space for constitutional arguments to be made beyond courts, where it collapses some of the distance between your position that we should kind of move away from judicial supremacy and from constitutional law altogether, and the kind of legalist position that reformers in the 70s occupy. And that is to say that I don't see why Congress and the DEA shouldn't have to take into account the liberty, privacy, racial equality, and other costs to their policies when designing drug laws. Right now, they don't do that at all, as far as I can tell. I think there's space for making new kinds of constitutional arguments, perhaps framed more broadly than drug rights in terms of, say, right to health. Here I sound a little bit like maybe Joey Fishkin and Willie Forbath, to the political branches that can kind of motivate and mobilize political reform without locking us into juristocracy. But still, I guess I want to fall back on the point that this is an area where there's a tremendous volume of criminal litigation, whether we like it or not, and therefore it behooves us to think of immediate constitutional responses to overcriminalization, even if ultimately it would be better to leave constitutional law behind and do most of the reform politically.
Okay, so let me follow up in a couple of ways. So the first one is this. I mean, why not just lean into, let's say, your authorial choices of, and say, my book shows what happens when you lose the constitutional battle, and some vast domain of policy is deconstitutionalized, especially when it comes to the vulnerable and weak. I mean, that would be like the standard view of liberals just across the board about why we need constitutional remedies. And your book could be taken as like a brilliant illustration of how, especially if you take David's view about like people just like hating decriminalization, well, then we need to coax the Constitution to produce the liberal outcomes it's not. So just why are you being so friendly to my position when it seems like your book provides a lot of support for the need to rekindle liberal constitutionalism?
Well, some support. I mean, I guess partly my enthusiasm for that strategy is tempered by your point about the limits of contingency and possibility. So I'm trying to be realistic about that. Partly, a theme throughout the book, even though I am trying to reconstruct sympathetically the arguments of these reformers and criminal defense attorneys, is that it's really hard to construct constitutional doctrine to stop the most odious parts of the war on drugs while allowing ample space for healthy regulation everywhere else. Some of the arguments, if embraced, would have much broader deregulatory effects than on drugs. So I'm wary about the crudeness of constitutional law as a tool and the empowering of judges that would go along with it. So that all leads me to a somewhat ambivalent position on the proper role for constitutional law here. This is I could put it this way. Whatever the optimal balance of constitutional law versus, purely political responses to our social problems in general, what seems to me intolerable is to have constitutional law colonizing so many domains of our social and political life, and yet failing to do anything about this most outrageous of abuses of liberty, racial justice, and government rationality. So we kind of have the worst of both worlds. We have an over-large, over-aggressive common law in so many areas, and yet it's doing nothing, you know, to help in this paradigmatic case of government overreach. And that balance, whether we correct that balance by kind of leveling up and giving drug users more protections, like people have guns, you know, or we kind of level down and we just try to clear the field of constitutional law more broadly, as you've called for, either I think would be preferable to the equilibrium we're at.
And I've heard it's a very hard subject to teach these days. I don't know. I've heard something about it.
Well, Dave and I both teach it, and I haven't ever had trouble of the kind reported in the New York Times yesterday. Okay, but Dave, your answer kind of teed up my second follow-up, which is just about the last chapter, because, you know, it, in a way, the first and second options, that's to say liberal originalism and Europeanizing America, seem like they're more fanciful in the prospects for liberal success than the third. So they're almost like, you know, pipe dreams compared to like the very real possibilities, doctrine notwithstanding, that American politics in the 1960s and 70s did almost go in a different direction and in theory could again under proper conditions. So like, that's why I'm with you in the end, because the third chapter in a way like explores these other possibilities than deconstitutionalization, you know, almost out of like, you know, a conscientious desire to cover, you know, some nifty alternatives, but they're not ever real. Would that be unfair?
I think that's a little strong. For example, the proportionality arguments, I say, have already gotten pickup in the state courts. It's an interesting feature of our federal system that proportionality review tends to be embraced by state high courts much more than the federal courts. And there's a kind of burgeoning literature on that. And I reread all of the greatest hits of American drug rights decisions, of which there are dozens that I canvass throughout the book, as all basically an ersatz form of proportionality review. Every time state courts are finding that the government has gone too far in criminalizing this or that substance, they're doing a kind of balancing analysis that would be familiar in South America, Europe, or anywhere else. So I guess I see some plausible scope for pushing in a proportionality direction in the state courts, which are at the front line of a lot of these drug cases. Originalism is a more complicated story. I'll just name one argument that seems to me pretty clean, which is John Stiniford and others have tried to reconstruct the original understanding of the cruel and unusual punishment clause circa 1791. And their work is powerful, that it was actually understood quite capaciously, not just to forbid barbaric modes of punishment, but punishment that fails to fit the crime in terms of retributive theory or moral desert, which applies quite neatly to nonviolent drug defendants. And that one's just sitting there on the shelf, you know, waiting for pickup by supposedly originalist judges, though we get to the politics. But yeah, but finally, I do end up saying it may be more plausible overall that the work common law does is beyond the arguments that are made by lawyers who have a defendant who you know faces prison time and they'll try anything that's at all plausible, will be to assist political movements in trying to seek liberalization. So one thing I probably should say more about in the book than I do find helpful here is that in the 60s and 70s, there seemed to be a real positive feedback loop between drug rights decisions and political reform. So that when you have courts recognizing limited forms of drug rights, that didn't crowd out political liberalization, political reforms in those states, it seemed to catalyze them. So I do think there could be kind of a healthy relationship between people advancing arguments for more humane drug policies in a constitutional register that help the political cause rather than cannibalize it. Let me just say one more thing on that, which is I find it so striking. I say this in the intro of the book, that the leading drug reform groups today Some of their central themes and tropes include individual liberty, racial equality, and reasoned government decision-making, all of which they say are compromised by the war on drugs. Those are the central tropes of modern American constitutional law, or at least among them. And yet they never invoke the Constitution. So if as Fishkin and Forbath and many others say, there's some rhetorical and political force in our culture to framing arguments constitutionally, even beyond the courts, it seems like a move that's just sitting there for them to make if they are kind of, if this history is brought back to life. And once again, these arguments seem non-frivolous.
I feel like you're leaving out of originalism arguments the great monologue by Slater in Dazed and Confused about Martha Washington being a really cool chick and setting up bowls for George Washington. So I have a couple of questions. One, I want to come back to the kind of viability or optimality of proportionality review. But I first want to, like, one con law move that is left on the table in the book is kind of like a generational move or constitutional time type move. And you talk a little bit about Doug Ginsburg during the story, yeah. And like, but you don't do you don't highlight maybe the two most famous like individual hypocrisy stories, which are Bill Clinton, I smoked but I didn't inhale, and Barack Obama, you know, talking about doing a little blow in college. And I wonder a little bit about whether, like, the Obama story, he's a little bit of a later character, is like, whether the story, like, is this a story of the con law of the baby boom? Is this the OK boomer constitutional law story where you have, or maybe even response to the baby boom? So, like, baby boomers get involved in, and then, like, the need to fight their off. So some version of that helping to explain the story, because it's, well, drug use is constant. Particularly your focus on marijuana was very clearly a generational fight going on in the 60s and 70s. So did you think about doing that in the book, or anything about like telling the story not as a continuous story but a generational story?
I suppose I didn't lean into that framing. And I'm not sure I've even interrogated to myself why I didn't. Maybe in part because I see drug use as a constant in American culture and all cultures, so that I'm a little wary of narratives about, you know, of generational narratives. This certainly was conflict around marijuana, and that plays out in some of the cases I discuss. On the Bill Clinton and Obama, I guess I talk a little bit about how what happens in the period after the 1970s is the kind of consolidation of anti-drug ideology and the rise of the youthful indiscretion trope as the preferred strategy of evasion for baby boomer officials, allowing them to, you know, kind of rationalize their hypocrisy. And so I guess I view that as part of the settlement that we reached after the fluidity of the 1970s. But there too, I guess, and the Douglas Ginsburg confirmation hearing, that's where he gets torpedoed because it comes out that he smoked pot while he was a professor at Harvard. I view as a moment in which there could have been a recalibration of our norms around certain drugs. There, it's interesting, the polling was very favorable to him. And initially, President Reagan says he stood by him and said he's not an addict or anything like that, trying to distinguish between more and less, you know, pathological drug behaviors. And so I view that as a kind of missed opportunity where marijuana could have been treated, recognized as less dangerous. But I guess rather than, you know, I'm not sure exactly what a generational framing would have looked like. It's part of the story of possibility, I guess, as I was talking about with Sam earlier. Why was it getting to be plausible in the 60s and 70s you could have drug rights? It's partly because this generational turn toward greater interest in personal fulfillment, experimentation, and just rising levels of drug use. So it's certainly in the mix there.
The one thing I wanted to say about proportionality is one of the central problems of courts, even in, is there are tools that aren't available to them, even in balancing constitutional rights. And the big one is affecting price in a really direct way, or just more difficult. So, like, they can't impose taxes under any circumstance. It's very hard. And the central problem I see, you know, I'm kind of influenced by Mark Kleiman's work on this, that there's a real problem with, he's known for is saying, like, in a free market for marijuana, the cost goes to zero. because it's like tea, it's a dryable good. And so it's like this, I mean, I'm just saying, like, maybe some skepticism or pushing towards a Sam type position rather than a, which I feel very uncomfortable with in all circumstances. But that the courts here have real disabilities in dealing with people's concerns about drug use, which are basically that if it gets too cheap, then some people will use too much of it. And we have the same problem in other areas. It's like maybe the central drama of alcohol regulation, which is we impose all sorts of non-price regulations, non-tax, we have things with distributors, and we have things with in order to raise the price without imposing taxes. But like, it's hard to know how a court would do any of that under any legal regime.
I think that's right. And that maybe that goes back to the earlier point about the difficulty of kind of getting legalization right. I'm not sure. You're right. There's no litigation in which this comes up directly. I know there's a big literature on the relationship of legalization to prices and to usage rates. I would just say, I think it's partly endogenous to the way legalization is pursued. If you do marijuana legalization, say, and the state really does a good job in controlling licensed dispensaries and not allowing unlicensed ones, then I think, you know, price can be calibrated to a level where, right?
Okay, if you can pass taxes, effectively, you know, or limit supply and some other mechanism. But it's hard for a court to do that kind of thing. That's an administrative regime. So even under a good common law system, it's hard to see how a court would help construct that.
Courts are clumsy actors here, though. Again, the one thing they can do pretty well is curb government overreach, which we have no shortage of in this space. Here, I'll just again point to proportionality is subtler though, and potentially more flexible. Where what a lot of those courts end up saying is constitutional courts around the world that have recognized limited forms of drug rights, that for certain classes of drugs that are on the benign side, criminal punishment for personal possession and use has no adequate or no sufficient justification. So we're going to rule that out. They don't restrict, you know, heavy taxation, licensing requirements, age requirements, or any of the other softer tools governments may use to limit drug behaviors. So I don't see any of that as ruled out by constitutionalization of this domain. I was going to pivot to just say, sorry, still respond to generational turn. This is not so much in the book either, but I wonder whether part of the current generational turn toward new openness to drug reform might be have a surprising source. And I'm thinking here of David Courtwright's work on the age of addiction. His book came out in 2019, I think. He's a very interesting historian of drugs, and he talks about the advent of limbic capitalism and how capitalism has always been about, you know, trying to get you to buy things you don't necessarily want or need. But what's new about the current period is, due to technology, companies now with a sophistication and scale previously unattainable can target those portions of your brain, the limbic system, that control pleasure and addiction. And of course they do, you know, think of social media, think of online gambling, think of junk food, you know, engineered to make you always want more. And it seems to me that in light of all of our relationships to our phones, say, to which we're all addicted, addictions have multiplied and have become a kind of pervasive feature of our commercial and social landscape. And it's therefore become like all the more odd and arbitrary to single out drugs as the one type of addiction we're going to get really concerned about. Not only that, some drugs like psychedelics are now touted as a means to curb your other addictions. You know, you want to reduce your addiction to technology or to alcohol, try these other drugs. So there's like a cross-cutting, you know, claims about how addiction operates even within the drug space. All of which is to say, I think in the background of this moment of possibility, maybe that we're in now around drug reform, is a new kind of ambient awareness of the ubiquity of addiction in our society, and therefore the need to think in more subtle ways about its sources and not just demonize one particular mode of addiction.
And I mean, I think you left out maybe the single biggest or one next to phones, next big, which is the rise of Ozempic, which is basically an addiction limitation drug. In a lot of ways, it seems to operate across types of addictions, not just food. But so this is actually where I wanted to end up, and I think it's a great way to end, which is, it does seem that the political economy has changed here. Many of the forces that you note were limited in the internal materials are not true. So, a real consumer market, you have real interests. I mean, you can see, we briefly mentioned New York's like ridiculous rollout system, but one of the problems is because all of the stores have opened, they're very hard to close because landlords are reliant on all these illegal stores are paying rent when other people are not. And you also have a huge amount of money going into ketamine treatments, like drug money going in, microdosing, Elon Musk microdosing and all of this stuff, Silicon Valley people. And so the question I have is, like, do you think that the con law will respond to this? I mean, we can see the politics changing. But do we think that these arguments are going to become or drug legalization arguments in con law are permanently walled off or semi-permanently walled off by the doctrinal moves of the story you tell? Or alternately, do we think that, like, we're just about to, and if so, what do you think, make one bold prediction for a one or more, if you want, as many as you'd like.
Certainly, I don't think constitutional possibilities are permanently walled off. The story the book tells is of significant, fluctuation across time periods in what arguments are seen as off or on the wall. So I never make a claim that bold. I'm not so optimistic in the immediate term about constitutionalizing drug rights as your first question, I think, got at. It does seem like the pendulum is swinging back toward a more punitive posture, which worries me and suggests to me that, by the way, reformers would do well to try to entrench whatever they can in constitutional law now for at least some short-term or medium-term gain. But I do think that the recovery of the idea that drug rights are possible and that the Constitution might have something to say about punitive prohibition could play out in any number of ways, could be cashed out under any number of clauses. But that is something that over the medium term could be useful to reformers. At least at the margins. More immediately, let me make the bold prediction. One argument that hasn't come up that was actually not a central argument in the 1970s, but started to be articulated and has now gotten a lot of steam abroad, is a First Amendment argument not grounded in the free exercise of religion, people claiming that drug use is a spiritual or sacramental practice for them, but in the free speech clause, and in the case law that recognizes free speech as protecting freedom of thought. And here we have a whole body of First Amendment scholarship now led by people like Shauna Shiffrin and a whole body of advocacy abroad about what some call cognitive liberty, and that you have a right to control your cognition or your perception, at least as long as you're doing so in reasonably safe and predictable ways. This is a new argument for limited forms of psychedelic drug rights, for example, that they stimulate cognition in ways that should be recognized by the free speech clause. If that sounds crazy, consider that in 1969, the Supreme Court said that obscenity, which is by definition not speech in the meaning of the First Amendment, is protected by privacy and freedom of thought rationales under the First Amendment in Stanley versus Georgia. Which is just to say that what you kind of alluded to earlier, how tech bros and a bunch of high-powered elites now really love their psychedelics, and there's just this general mainstreaming of psychedelics in a therapeutic key. See Michael Pollan's "How to Change Your Mind," for example. All suggest it combined that social political development with the Roberts Court's neo-Lochnerization of the First Amendment and its deregulatory jurisprudence and anti-paternalistic jurisprudence under the Free Speech Clause. And I think it's not crazy that some version of a cognitive liberty claim for drug rights could get litigated and make some headway in the coming years. That's the radical, I don't know.
Perfect.
Surmise.
Perfect. Yeah.
Thanks so much, Dave.
Yeah. This was awesome. It's a really fun book. It's a really fun book, and I certainly enjoyed it. And I'm sure all of our listeners will too. It'll be on con law syllabuses starting. You know, it doesn't get published for a few months, but it's even before it is, it'll be available to follow you. So thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks so much. It will be open access too, so it will be just a PDF online when it's done. Which
respond to the crisis in con law teaching by teaching Dave's book. There you have it.
And Sam, I should say you were in my head as I drafted the book as the contingency skeptic and played, I hope, a useful kind of disciplining role. Though, you know, I do want to again bring the law back in here and argue for some limited forms of autonomy and possibility. But I learned a lot from your work in thinking through that challenge.
Okay.
Thank you.